Amen. All right, we are looking at Luke chapter 23. We are picking up here in this particular section where Jesus has now is being kind of passed off to the next group of religious leaders and civic leaders. If you recall from the previous section, he is arrested in the end of chapter 22. He is taken into the house of the high priest, and kind of they have their own trial of sorts there. In the process of this, the apostle Peter, he denies Jesus in keeping with the prophecies regarding that. And of course, there then we find that as Jesus puts forward this testimony, now the group of religious leaders, they seek to bring about now a conviction. They bring this not just from the religious perspective, but from the civic perspective. The Jewish leaders have been convinced of what they thought about Jesus this whole time. They think that this guy is disrupting things, and you'll hear the charges here. But in order to bring about any sort of change, that they need to go to a higher authority, and at this time, as Israel is under Roman occupation, they go to seek Roman authority. And so this would be required in order to carry out the execution of Jesus and to carry out this guilty verdict, really. And so we're told in verse 1 that the whole company of them, all these people, they all get up, they go, and they bring Jesus to Pilate. Pilate is the Roman precurator at the time, and he would be responsible for kind of this region, for finances, for maintaining law and order. It was up to him to kind of rule this particular area, and as a part of this, he formed partnerships with the religious leaders. So there was a relationship that would be existing with the existing leadership, but a part of the ability for the Jewish people to still operate within the oversight of Rome, there was a formality that would take place every year where Pilate or the Roman government would appoint a high priest annually. So it would be that person's job to say, okay, you know, you're under our rule. We are going to allow you to go ahead and run the Jewish people within our oversight. And so there was a relationship that had existed there, particularly with the high priest Caiaphas, because he had been appointed, for 10 years consecutively. And so there was a longstanding relationship that was in place here. And so they come up and bring Jesus before Pilate. Here the religious leaders do. And we're told in verse 2 that they begin to accuse him. They bring these official charges against Jesus. And they accuse him with three particular things that you're going to find here. Number one, they say that he is misleading the nation. So as they bring out this first charge, this is more of a religious charge here. Jesus says that I'm sent from God to show the nation the way of God and how God is working. And so in bringing this charge before Pilate, they are confirming that they reject Jesus's message. They're saying, we have heard what he says, we understand what he's saying, and we outrightly reject it. We don't think it's true. We don't want any part of it. Beyond that, they bring a second charge that is completely false. They say that he forbids us from giving tribute to Caesar. Now, this is a totally trumped up charge. They're totally making this up. If you recall, a few chapters back, Jesus specifically tells them how to navigate paying taxes. They try to put him on the spot, and he tells them, well, why don't you give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's? He points out not to say that they shouldn't give anything to Caesar, but he's really more highlighting the fact that the totality of mankind belongs to God. that you are not able to loophole yourself out of it and being like, okay, well, some things are man's and some things are God's. He says, no, everything belongs to God, and God has appointed this group of people here. And so being a part of that, you should render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And so they bring this second charge saying, well, you know, Jesus told us that we shouldn't be paying taxes and, you know, we shouldn't be participating in supporting the Roman system here. And so he really wants us, to stop. He's forbid this. And this charge would mean that, specifically, bringing financial risk to Rome. And all, more than that, it would bring Pilate, who was in charge of the financial situation of this region, it would really threaten his rule, and kind of put him on the spot. Now, the kind of nastiness of this charge is that the religious leaders are really upset about Jesus because he's specifically not doing what they want. They wanted a Messiah who was going to come in and overthrow Rome. They specifically wanted someone to come in and drive them all out. They really wanted someone to come in and get rid of the Romans. But Jesus doesn't do that. And now they're going to Pilate and saying, like, well, he's been trying to get rid of you guys. I mean, this could not be like further from the truth, right? He specifically is not trying to become the king in this particular area. He's not trying to overthrow Rome. And so this is the second charge. But then the third charge that they bring is probably the most important charge, and is a charge that specifically is true, but probably not in the sense that they suggest here. They tell Pilate, he says himself that he is Christ, a king, right? Because Pilate doesn't know what Christ is, so he's trying to explain this. They're trying to break it down for him and make it as offensive as possible. And so they're saying, they identify him in his claims, and they're saying, well, he's saying that he is Christ, he's a king, that Jesus declares himself to be this promised Messiah. They raise this issue of an alternative kingdom. Hey, Pilate, just want to let you know, this guy, he is really stirring things up over here. He's trying to start a revolution. He's trying to tell everybody don't pay taxes. He's trying to start an alternate kingdom to overthrow the Romans. You know, they're essentially trying to bring out these charges of treason. And Pilate, he comes back in verse 3, and he asks him, are you the king of the Jews? So the third charge, he kind of dismisses the first two charges like, Those seem lame. That's probably not accurate. But the third one, he's like, okay, like, let's just get to that one. Because if you really claim yourself as king, then you're going to kind of come with some sort of authority. You're going to try to establish yourself here. And so he says, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered him, this is Jesus' response, you have said so. So it's kind of like a really like mysterious sort of reply. It's something that, like, you're kind of like, what? But I think Pilate gets everything that he needs to know from that type of reply. Because Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. He's like, this guy does not want to fight. He's not trying to posture here. He's not trying to call out, you know, Pilate's rule and be like, Pilate, you have no authority here. We are the rightful kingdom. And like, you know, things should really be run this way. Jesus is like, yeah, that's what you said. He's just kind of like rolling with it. He's not trying to really say, you know, you guys should really leave this land. And he doesn't make any argument to kind of establish any sort of kingdom. He doesn't try to challenge Pilate's authority. He doesn't do anything except for just be like, yeah, that's what you said. It's like the bare minimum of a testimony. And so Pilate comes out and he tells them, I find no guilt in this guy. He is a king, but he's not out to overthrow Rome here. And so there, he's convinced that Jesus is no threat. He declares Jesus' innocence. Jesus, maybe he thinks Jesus is crazy. Maybe he thinks that, okay, I'll just keep an eye on this guy, but like he's not really like an issue right now. Like, I don't see any issue with him. And this really should have ended things here. Pilate makes his declaration. And it's done. But it doesn't. The leadership, the religious leaders, they double down. They want more. They are making it clear that they are rebelling against God. Because even Pilate is just like, nah, he's good. Like, let's just like let him go. And they continue. They want to get more intense. Look at verse 5. But they were urgent, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea from Galilee, even to this place. They don't want to accept Pilate's judgment. They're insistent. They're like, this guy, he is causing problems for you, Pilate. He's stirring up people, which is basically they're trying to be like, if you're really, have control of the region, you don't want this guy starting riots. You don't want him, like, you know, making people go against you or against anybody. We just want to kind of keep the status quo. We want to keep everything as it is. Don't change anything. That's kind of his approach here. And so in the process, they're all trying to convince Pilate that, like, you got to do something about this guy. And as Pilate's listening, he hears something. His ears kind of perk up a little bit. Look at verse 6. When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. Because he's like, hey, this guy's around there. I'm getting some Galilean vibes off of him. And so he learns that Jesus is a Galilean. Verse 7, and when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. So Herod is around. He seems that Pilate's like, okay, well, like, this guy, he's not really under my jurisdiction primarily anyways. And since you guys are all, like, upset about it, let's just send him over to Herod, because Herod can kind of weigh in on the issue, and he'll figure out, like, whether this is a real problem or not. Now, as you look at this, and you move down a little bit further, you find out that Pilate and Herod are not really friends, right? They don't like each other too much. And so this isn't Pilate trying to throw him a bone. This is Pilate trying to, like, get rid of his responsibility to just, like, really deal with these guys. He's like, I'm just going to make this someone else's problem. He's not like, hey, like, you know, I really want to make this like a, this is not my area of expertise or my jurisdiction. He's using that as an excuse to kind of just be like, can you guys just, like, leave? Like, this is not the biggest problem in my day right now, right? Just, like, go, like, let somebody else deal with it. That's kind of, like, basically what happens here. And so he is trying to get out of this, you know, responsibility to make this decision here. But in the process of this, he also involves the highest level of Jewish leadership, because Herod was involved. His parents, like, he was, like, half Jewish, and he ruled over a Jewish area. So he was kind of like the highest level of Jewish leadership over that particular region. And so he gets sent to be judged now by Herod. So here's how Luke describes it for us in verse 8. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he long desired to see him because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. So Herod is pumped. He is so excited that Jesus shows up here. Now, this tells you a little bit about Herod, because Herod, this guy is wishy-washy. If you remember back in Luke 13, Herod wished to kill Jesus, right? The disciples were like, why do you want to go there? Like, Herod wants to kill you. Like, this is not a good plan. Like, don't make your way over there. But Jesus has become famous enough, and his works have become noteworthy enough that Herod is like, well, I want to see some tricks too. Like maybe I'll kill him, but, like, let's see some entertainment here a little bit. Like, everybody else has got to see this, and I've only heard of these things. I haven't seen anything. People keep saying, like, this guy's got some cool stuff going on. Like, this is awesome. He's here. I don't even have to get him here. He's, like, already going to appear before me. And so he's thrilled. He's so excited at the prospect of seeing Jesus. He's wanted to see Jesus do his thing. But if you recall, in the background of that, okay, so there's two things. Herod earlier wanted to kill Jesus. But then also, all throughout the Gospel of Luke, if you go back to chapter 4, if you look at chapter 11, there are multiple sections where Jesus specifically calls out the issue, the problem with people who seek to see signs. He's like, you're going to seek out signs, but no sign will be given. You're here. You guys want to see flashy miracles? You guys want to see these things? He's like, nope. Because what's happening with that, what happened in chapter 4, what happened in chapter 11, was that people wanted to see him do cool things. They're trying to use him for their own entertainment. They're trying to use him as a means to an end. They're not excited about knowing Jesus and letting his signs be something that compel them to faith. They're just there to have him do party tricks. And so he's like, I'm not going to show you guys anything. He won't be manipulated in that way. If you try to put Jesus in a place where you're trying to get him to do things so that way you can get what you want, he's not going to participate. It only works. He only shows up strong when you are willing to confess your weakness. When you are willing to say, I'm not really sure what the outcome's going to be, but I need you to show up, Jesus. I need you to do the impossible because I don't see something that is possible. But when you have a predetermined outcome that you're looking for, when you have an expectation that you're wanting him to hit, and you say, well, do that thing because it will help me get to the expectation that I'm looking for, he's not going to play ball with that. He's not going to let you manipulate him in that way. He wants to be in a place where he is showing up and you are finding your satisfaction, your joy, your results in him. He's not a vehicle for you to get other things. And Herod here is wanting exactly that. He wants to be the recipient of this entertainment. And so he shows up and he's like, okay, Jesus, let's do this thing. He questioned him at some length. He tries to get Jesus to respond, but Jesus says nothing. He keeps his mouth shut. Now, centuries later, you read the book of Acts and you look back and you see that Christians read into the situation of him appearing before Pilate and the religious leaders and of course here before Herod. And you see that they interpreted Isaiah 53 in light of this passage. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to a slaughter and a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Here he is made the testimony of who he is already. If you have not been listening thus far, you're not going to listen now. He has tried to make it plain. He's invited the chief priests and scribes and Pharisees to know. And they have decided what they believe. So much so that they are able to go to Herod, they are able to go to Pilate and also to say, hey, this guy, he's confessing himself to be the Christ, a king. This guy, he's here and he's trying to change things up in our nation. I mean, clearly they got the message. They just didn't agree with it. They didn't want him to do what he wanted to do. And so he makes this question. They question him at some length, but he made no answer. And in the process, the chief priests and the scribes, they continue to try to provoke Herod. They escalate things. They stood by vehemently accusing him, verse 10 tells us. And Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been with enmity with each other. So they keep pressing, the religious leaders keep pressing Jesus, or Pilate, Herod before, as Jesus is before him. And all of a sudden now Herod goes from wanting to be entertained to now, if you don't give me what I want, Jesus, then now all of a sudden I'm going to start being nasty to you. That's exactly how we get when God doesn't give us what we want. Right? Like, there's 100%, that's how it is. If someone doesn't give you what you want, then you're like, well, fine. And you start to get an attitude and you start to treat them poorly. That's exactly what happens here. Herod's like, hey, show me the party tricks. And as soon as Jesus is like, no, then all of a sudden he joins in with the soldiers and he's treating them with contempt and mocking him. And beyond that, he dresses him up. He arrays him in splendid clothing and sent him back to Pilate. Now, this is kind of like an interesting like little move here that happens. Some of your translations might say like royal clothing, or it might say bright clothing. There's two things that could be happening here. It could be either like a bright white kind of apparel, or it could be the like the regal purple apparel that would be for a king. The bright white is interesting because it is within that culture, it would have been a particular type of toga that would have been given to candidates for someone who was potentially going to become royalty or the king. It was like you had this particular type of robe that was handed to you in this process. Like, okay, well, like we're going to just put you out here and see if you can really stand up to it, right? And then also there's the other idea. It could be either of these. We don't know, but both kind of fit the bill of mocking. And in the process of this, he gets sent back, and Herod and Pilate become friends. They're united over this situation. Like, I couldn't deal with them either. Like there was nothing for me to do with this guy. Like, what do you want? Like, I can just imagine them being like, can you believe these religious leaders? Like, these guys will not go away. Like, this is so stupid that we have to deal with these guys again. Like, I send them over there, and they won't take no for an answer. And, you know, like whatever it is that's bonding them together, they have opportunity to stop this sequence of events, but they kind of keep the ball rolling. And so Pilate calls everybody together again. In verse 13, Pilate called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people. Now, new group shows up. Elders, chief priests, scribes. But now we also get the people. The people as active participants in this story. The nation gathers to decide Jesus' fate. And the people that had originally gathered to ask for his kingdom to come are now gathering in opposition. And here's what Pilate says in verse 14. And he said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him." Now, this little section with these three verses here is probably like one of the most important sections for you to understand. Because Pilate gives his verdict already. He sends him to Herod, and Herod gives his verdict, and they come back. And they declare that Jesus is innocent. So a proclamation is being made. We heard the charges that you brought. This guy, none of them stand up. We send him to Herod, and Herod's like, yeah, this guy's not like doing all this crazy stuff that they say he's doing. Everyone's been paying the taxes. We got no problems here. It's all bunk. None of this is a big deal. The Jews claim they have these three charges against him, but Pilate finds nothing. Herod finds nothing. More evidence of Jesus' innocence shows up when Jesus comes back, because you have a second testimony. So Herod returns that. Now, the second testimony is key, because according to the Jewish law, if you had an accusation, you bring two or three witnesses. So they show up with their two or three witnesses, and then he gets tried, and now Jesus has his two witnesses, the people who are ruling all the people. So by law, he should have been released. He's got Pilate making this declaration. Hey, this guy, there's nothing wrong with this guy. He's innocent. He goes to Herod, and Herod's like, yeah, there's nothing wrong with this guy. He's absolutely innocent. So by law, he should have been freed. He should have been, by the Jewish law, he should have been freed. All the evidence says Jesus should be released. But Pilate knows there's a political game here. And so he's like, okay, I'm going to punish him and then I'll release him, right? He thinks he can kind of get away with this and kind of pass it off if he just brings out this bit of punishment upon Jesus. So then they'll be like, okay, yeah, he'll kind of take that, and then, you know, they'll be happy that things have kind of moved a little bit. He offers this compromise to whip Jesus. And he thought that that might clear things up, but it doesn't. Look at verse 18. But they all cried out together, away with this man and release to us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder. So Pilate offers to release Jesus, and the crowd responds back as a group. And they're like, we want this guy, Barabbas, who is described here as a criminal, and they want to take Jesus away. Away with this man, release to us Barabbas here. Now, when they say, you know, away with this guy, that's basically saying, like, we want you to execute Jesus, and we want you to give us Barabbas. Now, Barabbas is kind of like basically the modern day equivalent of like a revolutionary, an insurrectionist. And the crowd would rather free him than free Jesus. Barabbas led a rebellion, an uprising against Rome, committed murder for which he was thrown into prison. And what's actually happening here is that Barabbas actually did the things that the religious leaders were accusing Jesus of. Like, he was that one who actually did it. He actually was trying to overthrow Rome. He's actually trying to get people to stop, like, paying the taxes. He's actually trying to start, like, an alternative kingdom and society. He's trying to do those things that they're bringing to Jesus and saying, like, oh, you did all this. And so they ask for him to be released instead. They want to take Jesus away. And Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus, but they kept shouting, crucify, crucify him. So he attempts to bring justice again. He kind of resists the crowd's cry a little bit. He's like, you guys are, like, getting out of hand. This is getting crazy. Like, I'm not really sure why you want to get rid of this guy. Like, let me just get rid of Jesus. Pilate knows it. Releasing Barabbas is going to be a bad idea because he's actually an insurrectionist. But he kind of begins weighing his decisions here, like, either I'm going to have an actual riot right here with these people, or I can kind of, like, deal with probably this guy trying to start another revolution in, like, you know, a few weeks when he gets out and he tries to rally more people. So, like, do I want to deal with this now while the city is full of people, or do I want to deal with this later? And it seems that because of the kind of political situation, because of the masses, they kind of keep asking. And Pilate cannot understand, like, why these people are so insistent. A third time, verse 22, he said to them, why? What evil has he done? I have found no guilt in him, no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him. So again, Pilate's like, this guy is 100% innocent. Like, this makes no sense. Why are you guys stuck on killing this guy? He gives a double declaration of his innocence. He's like, what evil has he done? Like, I can't find anything. He has no charge to bring against him. He finds nothing worthy of death. Right? Pilate can't even, Pilate's job here, he's like, okay, we're going to carry out this execution. Like, I literally have no charges to write on, like, his thing to put next to him why he's being executed. Like, there's nothing I can write, right? And that's why he's confused later when he actually has to go through this. He's like asking him, like, what do you guys like want me to write? Because, like, I literally got nothing. But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified. And their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. So they don't want to compromise. They don't want to hear these calls of innocence. The people refuse to let Pilate's verdict stand. And so their voices prevailed. The people's protest works. Pilate gives them the judgment that they want to hear. But we're kind of meant to see that, like, everybody's at fault here. Nobody in the story is, like, getting away with this. As much as Pilate resists in trying to bring out the innocence, he gives in to the crowd. He doesn't stand for true justice. He doesn't say, like, I don't care what you guys want. Like, this is an injustice. He doesn't release Jesus unscathed. The religious leaders are stirring up the people. The people are opposing Jesus. Everybody is complicit. No one escapes. They are all urging this on. And so the results happen. Verse 25, he released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked. But he delivered Jesus over to their will. So Pilate releases Barabbas. Luke doesn't mention his name here, like, the second time. He just calls him the man. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder. And in his place, the innocent is placed among the criminals. Jesus is condemned despite what Pilate has said, despite what Herod has said, despite the declarations that he has done nothing wrong. Jesus is put forward as a criminal to receive the punishment that Barabbas would have received. What does it say there? He says that he released a man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder. That punishment was now going to go to Jesus. He would now be the recipient of that punishment. Jesus will now suffer on behalf of Barabbas. But beyond that, he steps in as the true suffering son. We've talked about this before, but it's an almost, you know, not even exchange, but it's a complete substitution. Barabbas, he is really just, it's kind of a, it's not really like a name. It's more of like a title, right? So it means son of the father, right? Abba, father, bar is like of, right? So you would be saying what your name was. And his actual name is Jesus. So he's Jesus Barabbas. So you have Jesus Barabbas and you have Jesus Christ together. both Son of the Father, both facing judgment, and in the process of this, humanity decides that the one who has actually committed the crimes goes free. And the one who is blameless, who is spotless, receives those punishments instead. It's absolutely an unfair situation. It's unjust in every way. The only justice in it is this: Jesus volunteered. No one forced him to do it. No one said, hey, sorry about this. This is really not working out well for you. Like, you just got a bad roll of the dice. Things are terrible. He decided that he wanted to come and rescue and save. He knew that we would be the people who would be paying for our mistakes, our transgressions, our sin. And he said, I will come and pay that price. I will step in. Because this group of people here, they're all insurrectionists. They're all in rebellion against God. They are all out to kill one another, and they're trying now to kill me. All of us have gone astray. Not one person here has lived a perfect life. Not one person here is better than another person here. We are absolutely all in the same spot. I don't care where you're from, what you've done, where you've been. We are all absolutely at the same spot. We need the forgiveness of Jesus. We're all the same. And we all receive that same invitation to trust in Christ for salvation. Jesus is condemned as a criminal in our place so that we might take his place, that we might go free. Friends, he volunteered. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't something that just like by happenstance, like, oh, bad luck for him. No, he saw where we were at. And he said, I'm coming to get you. I will lay down my life as a ransom for many so that you might go free and have the ability to walk in newness of life. And the most radical thing about this is that Jesus knows in all the things that we did, he came to save us, has risen again, invites us into his family, and treats us as if none of those things happened. We are treated with kindness and gentleness. We're treated as family. He's not holding it in the back of his mind like, well, you know, remember when I saved you? Remember, like, you know, you guys, you know, that's just where he's kind of trying to hold it over us. He wants to be with us, to know us. He wants us to enjoy the fullness of life with him. He's not asking us to walk in shame. He's not asking us to be stressed out and be remembering like, oh yeah, you know, it's just like because we're such bad people. He knew all that. That's why he came. So that way we didn't have to walk in that way. We keep blowing it. He's like, no, come on. Like, I'm here and I'm here to rescue you. Why do you think the next time we see him, like, not in the Bible, but like real time, why do you think the next time we see him we're having a party? Because he doesn't care about all that other stuff because he already paid for it. So he doesn't need you to come up and be like, yo, like, hey, like, good to see you again. Like, really sorry about all that stuff. He's not, like, that's not a part of the exchange. It's just parties from here on out. So you don't have to walk in shame. You don't have to walk in this stress, like, condemnation. We can walk forward in the newness of life that he has given to us. He willingly went in so that we might be released, that we might have new life, and that we might take on his righteousness while he receives the punishment that we should have. And we respond to that. We rejoice in that. It's new life for us all. And I look forward to growing in that and walking in that together with all of you. Let's respond together. Lord, we are thankful for your word, for your kindness, for your goodness to us. We're thankful that you have rescued us and saved us. We're thankful that you have brought us into a new era where you are not dealing with us according to our sins. Our interactions are not on the basis of our transgressions, but they're on the basis of your work that you have accomplished on our behalf. And so, Lord, would you be glorified in our lives as we remember what you've saved us from? And we just want to say thank you. That's really all we can do. We want to say thank you, and we want to live for you. And so help us. Help us as we walk together. We love you. Amen.